Chris Boyd. Up next on Think, the novelist chosen by Marvel to write the next installments in the Black Panther series, envisioning the leader of Wakanda as a woman. Nnedi Okorafor's stories draw on her background as a Nigerian-American and on her extraordinary gift for imagining whole worlds into existence. Her fantasy, Who Fears Death, is currently being produced as an HBO miniseries by Game of Thrones creator George R.R. Martin. We'll talk with Okorafor about how growing up with a foot in two cultures helped shape her creativity and about why she's not crazy about being labeled an Afrofuturist. Our conversation starts after a short break. Debate about the coolest scenes in the movie Black Panther, but I don't know how anybody could disagree that the coolest character is Shuri, the whip-smart, tech genius, comedic genius, teenage kid sister of King T'Challa. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. It's hard to imagine anybody better suited to telling the next chapters of Shuri's story for Marvel Comics than Nigerian-American writer Nnedi Okorafor, who has built an award-winning science fiction and fantasy career around protagonists shaped by African culture and mythology. And now Okorafor's novel, Who Fears Death, featuring another strong and extraordinary young woman, is being turned into a series for HBO by George R.R. Martin, otherwise known as the guy who wrote Game of Thrones. Nnedi Okorafor is here now to talk about her writing and her career. Nnedi, welcome to Think.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
So you grew up in the U.S. Your parents are from Nigeria. How did your heritage play into the way you were raised?
It is part of how I was raised. So both of my parents, they came to this country in 1969, and they weren't able to go back because of the Biafran Civil War broke out, and so that was their reason for staying. They had intended to return, and so for that reason, I was born here. At that time, they lost contact with most of their family, and so as soon as they reestablished contact, they started bringing my siblings and I back to Nigeria to meet family, to reconnect with our heritage, all of that. So at the same time, you know, we were born and raised in the United States, so we were having a very American experience. And then in the middle of that, during Christmas and Easter, in almost, what was it, maybe about every year or every 2 years, we would go back and reestablish and have all these amazing experiences. So those, even though those trips were very short, they tended to be about 2 to 3 weeks, those trips had an incredible impact on my sisters and I, because for one, we learned a lot about who we were. You know, we learned what our names meant. We learned we heard the language that our parents spoke in a greater context. We learned where it was all from. We connected with our cousins and had fun with them. So it wasn't just knowing their names. We knew them. It was really incredible. And that kind of deeply affected who we were. So when we came back from those trips, it wasn't that we were someone else or that we were different people. We just were a lot more, and we're a lot more secure in who we were. So we could move through the United States able to explain what our names meant or how to pronounce our names and where they came from and all of that. So that the heritage of my parents had a great impact on just on my upbringing.
So did you always feel like you fit into two places, or... Yeah.
I would say it was being Nigerian American, you felt that you were an inside outsider. So you fit into, like, even in the United States, to fit into the African American community, I also would always know that that my parents came here on an airplane. It wasn't that they came here through the horrible experience of slavery and then were here for many generations. It was that they were freshly in the United States. So there's that. But at the same time, I grew up dealing with a lot of racism. Mm-hmm. And so I know that very American, specifically American experience. So I have that. So there's that insider outsider feel. And then on the Nigerian side, my relatives are all there. You know, it's like when we go to Nigeria, it wasn't going there as a tourist. It was going there to visit your people. You know, you're one of them. But at the same time, you're still an American Nigerian, or I call it Nigerian American, and you're very aware of that. You don't. Your accent is different. Your background is different. You relate to things in a different way. So, but at the same, you're on the inside. So that insider outsider thing. And growing up, it was something that my siblings and I, we actively engaged in that. We weren't like, okay, we want to fit in, so we're going to try to be just this or just that. We knew from a very young age that we were both. And that was something. That was something in itself, and that had its conflicts. And we engaged with those. We discussed. Those things. We never denied either side of what we were.
It's a really interesting perspective for someone who's written a lot of characters who have special abilities that no one else has. That sometimes might look like a burden, and other times might be really extraordinary.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, it's. I think that I draw a lot from that with. With my characters, I think one of the reasons why I ended up writing this science fiction, fantasy, mystical type of literature has to do with being Nigerian American and straddling, being so used to straddling borders and understanding what it is and understanding the magic of those borders, and a lot of those things have manifested in my characters.
Reading your work. Which has such an African sensibility. Mm. I read Who Fears Death. It reminded me of how Eurocentric everything
yes.
that I read and have read for much of my life mm-hmm. has been. It's like something that we don't even consider until we're confronted with the reality that there are lots of different ways to look at the world.
Yes, yes. Point of view is something I've always been interested in. Point of view, and that also comes back to the Nigerian American thing, because I'm very aware of point of view and perspective and how that shifts perception. I'm very aware of that. And so when I was writing Who Fears Death, I was very interested in telling things from and I say African, not as African being Africa being a country, Africa as a continent. I'm purposely generalizing right now, but I wanted to tell the story from an African perspective and understand, and I understood very clearly what that meant. It's not just a general, oh, I'm speaking from this character's point of view. It's you have to understand the way that point of view affects your perception. So even just looking at the history of things, you're looking at the history of things from the point of view of something already. And so Who Fears Death is very much written from an African perspective. So therefore, the cosmologies you get are deeply African. The ideologies that you run into, the way people think, the way people behave, the expectations characters have, the creatures that appear, the mythical creatures that appear, like all those are from that perspective. And so for that reason, many who read Who Fears Death will be like, this has a really foreign feel to it. But at the same time, the beauty of narrative and the beauty of story is that story, like when it's well done, is universal. So regardless of what point of view you're coming from or what ideology you're used to, you should be able to kind of enjoy and catch on to and hang on to the story of Who Fears Death, despite the fact that it really is very much an African point of view.
You also give us a really nuanced take on contemporary issues, including like FGM and
yes.
the shunning of people who have been sexually assaulted. These are things that are still reverberating in many parts of the world. And yet the novel, as far as I can tell, takes place sometime in the future.
Mm-hmm.
We don't know quite when. It looks like you imagine that these will continue to be issues for people.
Yeah, human beings are human beings. You know, that's the reality of it. And I do a lot of extrapolating when I'm thinking about, like, you know, how will things be? What issues will still be there? And I also just wanted to explore issues like female genital mutilation. I wanted to explore that in a way where, okay, in the future, if things are addressed, how will this practice be? Because I feel like it's not going to completely stop, even if things are addressed. Because sometimes it's not just a matter of education. It's also a matter of culture as well. So in Who Fears Death, I was really thinking hard about how things will be, because it's still happening in this future. And this future is distant, and people are educated. The information is there for people to read. you know, but that's not enough. So it's like these things, you know, I was definitely thinking about a lot of these issues and the complexity of these issues when I wrote this, especially in the future. It's you just, I think there's more to it than I felt was being addressed. Yeah.
Yeah, and you give your protagonist, and help me if I'm saying the name wrong, Onye Sonwu?
Onye Sonwu.
Onye Sonwu.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
So you give the choice to her. Her mother mm-hmm. comes from a people that have outlawed this
yes.
practice, and this vulnerable teenage girl says, I already don't fit in.
Yes.
So if I do this, maybe I'll have friends. And to a certain extent, it works that way for her.
Yeah, it does. But at the same time, if it weren't for the systematic sense of the culture, she wouldn't have felt she needed to do that.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where it's like, so she had a choice, but did she really have a choice? It's that whole part of the book is very complex, you know, and she comes from, her mother has comes from a culture where it's been outlawed, but also outthought, you know, mm-hmm. and then her father loves them and he's from that culture, but he understands this needs to stop. But then she has her own issues that she's dealing with, and she ends up deciding, well, maybe if I do this, I'll be better off. And it does kind of bring her those things, but you still have to question the idea of what is choice.
Mm.
Like, what led her to have to make that choice, and did she really have a choice?
It's interesting for me to think about toggling back and forth throughout your formative years between a culture where like race and racism are woven into everything mm-hmm. and every bit of our history, and a culture where ethnicity is a big deal, but race maybe is mm-hmm. not something that divides people.
Yeah. Yeah. That was interesting. I think that was having that experience dealing with the racism of the United States and growing up in a very racist community. And then while I'm dealing with that, going to Nigeria, where it's all black people, you know, and so racism doesn't exist, and there is tribalism. I think that having like moving between those two worlds, especially in those formative years, that was really important in those formative years to see that, because I often wonder what I'd be like if I didn't have, you know, if I was not going to Nigeria and I just had that American experience and didn't have anything else to bounce it off of. But having that experience was really pivotal to me, because it taught me how big the world is, how diverse the world, it taught me very early that the world is diverse, that not everywhere is like this. And so if not everywhere is like this, then, you know, it doesn't necessarily have to be that way. And two, it's just bigger. It's just bigger than these issues. So I could look at things from a distance. You know, it gave me distance. It gave me that perspective where I could look at the United States from a distance, from the outside, which I think was really key in me understanding what exactly was going on from the inside when I was on the inside. So it was fascinating.
Forgive me for not knowing this. In Nigeria, is your ethnicity pretty clear to anyone who sees you from a distance?
Yeah, it's like, and this is something I've been thinking about a lot, because it's people can look at you and know it. If they can't figure it out from looking at you, they look at how you speak.
Mm-hmm.
They look at the language you speak. They'll look at your name, especially. Names are like really can give away everything. Like they can tell you like not just your ethnicity, but what part of the country your people are from. So names tell you a lot. Language is a big thing. But yeah, you can look. But it's not none of those things are 100%. None of those things. I know with both of my parents, people often thought that my mother was Fulani. So it's there, but it's not 100%, which nothing rarely is. So yeah.
My guest is Nigerian-American writer Nnedi Okorafor. She's the author of books including Who Fears Death, Binti, Akata Warrior, and Shuri Comics Now for Marvel. She's also a co-author of Black Panther, Long Live the King.
Try them on. Fully automated, like the old American movie Baba used to watch.
Mm.
And I made them completely sound absorbent.
Interesting.
Guess what I call them? Sneakers. Because you... Never mind.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with writer Nnedi Okorafor. That was a scene from the Oscar-nominated movie Black Panther, featuring Princess Shuri and her brother King T'Challa. I wasn't kidding in my introduction. She, like, long before I knew that I was going to talk to you, she's just the greatest character. Will you describe her for people who aren't familiar?
She really is. She's an amazing character. She is an engineer, and she is a genius engineer. And what's interesting is that the Shuri in the comics is very different from the Shuri in the movies. But she's a genius engineer who is T'Challa's little sister. She's gutsy. She's bold. She's very imaginative. And she definitely has her own mind. She definitely has her own mind. She's a really fun character to write.
So when you are going to sort of take on the mantle of a character that has existed and was born of someone else's mind, what kind of biographical information do you collect, and how do you know that you know everything?
Yeah, you could never know everything. The Marvel Universe is so huge, and Shuri has a lot of story already in the Marvel Universe in terms of the comics. So there's that, and I know that I went through and I read as many things that I could find that featured Shuri. So there was that, and then also there's the film, which, you know, I've watched how many times just for fun, let alone for research purposes. But then, like, once I've read all of that and then, you know, kind of looked at the film version of Shuri, it kind of, then there's that part of it where I have to, where one, I fused both of those characters together. And then also thinking about, like, there was just, once I fused the two characters together, sort of this new character kind of emerged, and she definitely has the voice of Letitia Wright. Like, every time I hear that voice, I can hear my character. But there is, you know, that was really the process of it, just kind of the fusing and then the imagining.
So Stan Lee and Jack Kirby, who created the character originally and the Black Panther world, brilliant guys, but also white American guys. How right did they get a story that takes place in Africa and is rooted in African culture?
Yeah. I think Shuri was created by, I believe, Reggie Hudlin. And I can't remember the year. But in terms of Black Panther and Wakanda, you know, Jack Kirby and Stan Lee created that. And I think over the years, both Wakanda and T'Challa, the Black Panther, have come a long way. They've evolved. Did they get it right? Over the years, they've evolved. I think, like, if you look at the very early Black Panthers, the very early iteration of Black Panther, it was a little, you know, simplistic and you know, it was fun. It was fun. It was definitely a strong character. But several writers over the years have kind of developed and evolved these characters to what we have now with the film and with the comics.
What's interesting about the Marvel comics, and people always describe it as a universe,
yes.
is that although you have a lot of creative license, there's an order to that universe, right? Like, vibranium has particular thermodynamic properties and that sort of thing. What does it take to know that you know the rules of Wakanda and the universe in which Wakanda exists?
Yeah, that's been fun. That's been really fun. It's like even with vibranium, I would actually research metal properties and alloys and how do different metals work, and then I'd also look at the various details about what, you know, about vibranium as a whole. So, like, there's like scientific research. There's science fiction research and scientific research that I'm blending with that, and the same goes with Wakanda. The location of Wakanda has shifted around a lot, but I think it's really kind of landed sort of in the region of Kenya, and in particular Turkana. And so, like, So that's what I go by for me. That's what I go by. So I kind of blend once again the regional stuff with the fictional stuff, and it's it requires a lot of digging, but that's really the fun of it as well.
So you mentioned that you traveled a lot to mm-hmm. Nigeria. Have you traveled throughout Africa?
I wouldn't say throughout, but I've been to different countries. I've been to Tanzania. I've been to Kenya. I've been to South Africa. I've been to Senegal. Yeah. I wrote the first issue of Long Live the King. I wrote that when I was in Tanzania. And I remember sitting in my room thinking, I'm not far from Wakanda, literally. And so this, I'm going to try to pull from that to kind of get the aura of where this mythical country is located. So that was definitely a part of the process.
As someone who has like firsthand knowledge of the fact that there are many, many countries in Africa, many mm-hmm. cultures, I wonder how you feel about the sort of Pan-African ethos that mm-hmm. that exists in certain kinds of literature, as compared with work that really specifically drills down to the way one group of people thinks and lives.
Yeah, I think that both are necessary. I think that both are very necessary. The Pan-African mythos kind of brings a lot of things together. And, even in my own work, I've done that, like where I've taken several different traditions from different countries and brought them together. I did that in Who Fears Death. I did that in Binti. I think that's necessary, but also the specificity, is that a word? Specificity?
Yes.
is also really necessary. I think the Pan-African sense is something that often comes from, I don't want to speak in absolutes, but often comes from the diaspora, from especially blacks in the diaspora. And that bringing together and connecting is extremely important. There's definitely a job for that, but also the being specific and having stories set in a specific place is important in a different way. Because a lot of times, I've heard this several times where it's often said about African narratives that, oh, this won't universally appeal to people. It's too specific. And that's not said about other types of literature that's said in other parts of the world. I think that's usually when I hear that, I know that that's very telling. That's very telling. And I think that stories are universal. Good stories are always universal. But the specificness, like the idea of Pan-Africanism is important, but also the being specific shows that there is diversity also in Africa. It's like Pan-African says they're both saying the same thing in two different ways, you know. And the being specific is really it begs questions about the concept of Africa, because the concept of Africa, when you really look at it, it's a false construct. So, yeah, I'm getting abstract here.
You mean like an imperialist concept of Africa? Is that what you mean?
Well, the concept of Africa was created, and the demarcations of Africa were created by Europeans. So there's that, and those demarcations often ignored the demarcations that already existed. In other words, those demarcations ignored the people, mm-hmm. ignored the what the people had already created long ago. And so when you're specific, you're not even thinking about those demarcations. You're kind of rejecting ideas of colonialism. And that's where that's important, where we're looking at a group of people in a specific place from their own perspective. That whole idea of perspective comes in with being specific. Yeah, I mean, it's a lot. I think that both ideologies are doing different things, but it all comes together eventually. Like it's all like a big general a general ideology. I think they're both almost two sides of the same coin. Yeah.
So you're often described in shorthand terms as an Afro-futurist. Before we talk about
African
futurist.
Yes.
Forgive
African.
Me. I've actually seen it both ways.
Yes.
So first of all, what does that term mean?
That's a good question, which is why I started rejecting the word Afro-futurism. It can mean a lot of things. It really depends. Okay, we'll talk about Afrofuturism. With Afrofuturism, one of my criticisms is that it means a lot of things depending on who says it. You know, some will say that it's basically another way of saying African science fiction or looking into the future. Others will say that it's a way of blacks looking into the future or being optimistic about the future. But it's rooted mainly in the United States, you know, and then it extends out from there. That's the definition that I reject. That's the definition that has been, how would I put it? Not canonized, but that's the definition that when you Google it, that's what you will come up with. And that's part of why I reject the term and call myself an African futurist, because I am more of the belief, for at least for my own work, that I'm coming out of Africa. Like my works, my ideas, the root of everything that I do comes out of there, especially Nigeria in particular, and then snakes out into the diaspora. Yeah, it's Afrofuturism is very hard to describe. There are definitions that include fantasy. There are definitions that include the idea that it's supposed to be optimistic all the time.
That's a burden, isn't it?
Yeah, that's what I mean. So it really depends, and I think that a lot of people really don't know what the term means, and it's so broad that it could mean anything. I've seen Afrofuturism I've seen works labeled as Afrofuturist where I'm like, what does that even have to do with what I thought it had to do? So it's so broad that when something is too broad, the definition loses its loses its structure, its form, and its purpose. Yeah.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. So you are often favorably compared to writers, including Ursula K. Le Guin and Octavia E. Butler. I wonder if you're bothered by the fact that you're put on a list of women science fiction writers, particularly as opposed to being on lists of science fiction writers, which is to take nothing away from their talents.
Yeah, I mean, not at all, really. It's like I am a woman and I am a science fiction writer. It is what it is. It's not something that's bothered me, even though it does mean that I'm not going to be compared to, like, no one's ever compared me to, let's say, Stephen King. And Stephen King has had a huge influence in the things that I write, like, very clear, even though I have my criticisms of Stephen King, so I will say that. But, it doesn't bother me. It doesn't bother me to be called an African writer. It doesn't bother me to be called a black writer. These are all things that I am. Mm-hmm. So, and I openly embrace those things. And those are not just things that I am. Those are things that that are at the root of what I do. You know, I mean, if you look at it, it's not something that I'm not sitting down and thinking, oh, I'm a black writer, so let me write black things. It's nothing like that. It's nothing so conscious. It is when I look back at all the things that I've written, and I've written how many books? I think of 15 books, I think, and counting. When I look at everything that I've written, you can see certain themes that come forth, and those tend to have to do with patriarchy, issues that women deal with, issues of Africa, issues of the black diaspora. Those are things that are just there because that is who I am. So to be called that kind of writer is fine.
Did it take half a dozen books for you to recognize that those themes would be persistent in your body of work throughout the course of your life?
Yeah, it really did, because I'm the type of writer who I don't even outline when I'm writing.
Really?
Yeah. When I wrote Who Fears Death, I didn't know what I was even writing. I didn't know who the character was. And the opening chapter, which is her at her father's wakekeeping, looking down at her father, like, that was the first chapter that I wrote. I had no idea who the character was. I had no idea what the story was. I had no idea why the community hated this woman. You know, I knew nothing. I was just writing. So that's how I write. So I don't think about, I don't outline. You know, I just get in there and start writing. And these themes came forth. And so when I look back on everything, you can see it very clearly, but it was organic. It was unintentional.
Sometimes when people describe writing that way, people like me listen and we think, wow, you just have this magical gift, as if there's not a lot of hard work involved.
Oh, there's work. Yeah. there's definite work. Who Fears Death took me 6 years to write, and it was over 700 pages. It was two books. Mm-hmm. And then my agent looked at it. He was like, oh, this is going to win awards. This is really great, but it needs to be one book. And I took another 2 years bringing this thing down, you know, like without changing plot, bringing it down to one book. And so there was so much work that went into that. Most of my books on average take about 4 years. And I'm all about the editing because, you know, when you write the way I write, yeah, the editing is definitely going to be a lot. And I think that, yeah, the work of it is part of it. It comes in this almost magical way. And I can definitely describe it as a magical way. There are times where I've written something and then I look back and I'm like, I don't even remember writing that.
Wow.
And I'm like, oh, but this is good. I'm really enjoying this. So there's that side of it, but then there's also the work aspect of the editing, you know, the polishing and the bringing forth and the adding and the moving things around, structural stuff. So, yeah, there's definitely a work side to it.
My guest is writer Nnedi Okorafor. She's the author of books including Binti, Who Fears Death, Akata Warrior, Akata Witch. She's also doing the Shuri comics now for Marvel, and she's a co-author of Black Panther, Long Live the King. This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with writer Nnedi Okorafor. She's the author of books including Who Fears Death and Binti, and she's working now on comics for Marvel, including the ones about Shuri. She's also a co-author of Black Panther, Long Live the King. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can call 800-933-5372. Okay, Nnedi, you were just talking about it taking 6 years to finish Who Fears Death. The editing is 2 years. You're in charge of every comma, every semicolon, every adjective. And then someone comes along and says, we want to make a TV series about it. That is a lot of control that
yes.
someone else gets to have.
Yes. It's good, though. It's good for novelists to not have control sometimes. I think it helps us kind of become and grow more. Because for me, before that, I had done, even though I'd done one brief comic, comic writing is very collaborative as well. But yeah, with this one, you know, I knew I had to let go, and it was uncomfortable. I will say that it was not easy. But also, I've always known that you grow and stretch and become more. The more you challenge yourself, like if you keep doing the same thing over and over again, you're not going to evolve at all. Mm-hmm. So challenging yourself is like one of those ways of doing it is to take on things that you normally wouldn't do, you know, that are new to you, that are uncomfortable. And in that way, you grow. And I think that's what's happened here.
What do you worry most about? Do you worry that the people won't look the way you imagine them, or the places won't look that way, or some part of the book's essence won't be translated?
Yeah, I think my worries would be all of those things. Voice is a big one for me. Voice and the voice that is centered in the story, because the voice is very strong. Who Fears Death is a first-person narrative. It is written in Onye Sonwu's voice, and her voice is very powerful. And that was one of my worries. Will this story be told in her voice? You know, will her voice come across? Will she be central? So there's that. In terms of, like, these are all, like, down-the-line kind of things, but, like, yeah, casting is always going to be an issue for me. I've seen what can happen with casting if it's not done properly. And casting would be very important with Who Fears Death, because she has a specific look, and it's set in a part of Africa, and we need to deal with that. And also, like several of the other characters, the other ethnic group in the story is Arab as well. And I'm like, okay, are they going to be able to pick that up? Because in the book, it's I felt it was clear, but I know that like some readers were like, okay, who are these new people?
Like they
couldn't figure it out, because I don't know if it's because it's in the future or what. But so that's something that I've worried about as well. But voice is really the most important thing, because I think if the voice is there, then everything else will fall into place.
I would think, and I have no experience parallel to this, but it might also be exciting in the way that if you're having your house remodeled, you get a sketch of it.
Mm-hmm.
But you hope to come in and be wowed.
Yeah, and not just be wowed, but like to come in and feel at home.
Yeah.
You know, that's really, you don't know it until you walk in, mm-hmm. you know, and you can have all the parts there and still not feel at home. So yeah, that's actually a good metaphor.
All right, I want to go to the phones now. Our number is 1-800-933-5372. Bill is calling us from Dallas. Hi, Bill.
Hi. I'm very interested in how writers are formed, and I'd like to know how your guest today, what she remembers reading as a little girl that had a huge impact on her, and how her reading changed over the years, and what she likes to read now. And I'll take my answer on the air.
Thanks for calling.
Great question. For me, I've always, one of the interesting things is I did most of my reading were in the libraries. The libraries were a huge part of my upbringing. We rarely, for some reason, rarely ever went to the bookstore. It was always the library. My mom would just take us to the library, and we were able to just, we were allowed to just go wherever we wanted to and pick whatever books. And in that way, I would find myself going in and not paying attention to categories at all. So I would just, I didn't, when I eventually ambled into the adult section, I didn't even know. And that was how I read Stephen King when I was 12. But in terms of like the writers that really formed me, like the first novel that I ever read were, and few people know what these are, but you can Google them, the Moomins. The Moomin series, they're from Finland, and they featured these Moomins, M-O-O-M-I-N. And they are basically like bipedal, really polite hippos. And they live in really nice, just a nice, nature-y place. And they have their tea and their little adventures. But really, in a lot of ways, very cheeky. The humor was cheeky. And there was this like this soft magic in their world that was almost like magical realism. And I love the Moomin books. Margaret Mahe, I think that's how you pronounce it. She's a New Zealand writer, M-A-H-Y. She wrote a book called The Changeover that I just loved. I absolutely loved that book. I read it over and over again. I read a lot of science books, a lot of them. I was obsessed with bugs, obsessed. So field guides were a big thing for me. I discovered the author Isaac Asimov, not through his science fiction books, but through his science books, because
wow.
He actually wrote science books. That's how I knew him. And I read iRobot much later. But so I read a lot of his science books. And yeah, and Stephen King. It keeps coming back to Stephen King. I read Stephen King's It when I was 12. Had no business reading that. Was very terrified of the clown, all of that. But reading that was the first 1,000-page book I ever read, and it just taught me about narrative and story, and it drew me in. I had ambled into the adult section of the library, saw this book with this green claw coming up from the sewers, and it just pulled me in, and I opened it, and I read the first page, and I was hooked, because that's how it is for me. I just read the first page, and I'll know if I'll love the book or not, and I was immediately hooked, and I read a lot of horror growing up, too, which was interesting. Stephen King, Clive Barker, Robert McCammon. Those were my three authors. So it, like the things that I read growing up were diverse and strange. But like I read very widely. I read very just a bit of everything.
I read a lot of Stephen King as a kid, too, including like the back catalog of books that nobody's heard of because they weren't very good. So I'm just curious. You said you have some concerns, some criticisms of Stephen King. So what are those?
Well, one of them is, and Stephen King is one of my top three favorite writers of all time. So we'll preface it with that. But he has a lot of magical Negroes in his,
Shining.
The Shining, The Stand, The Talisman. I could go, like, he has a lot of them. It's that one black character in a predominantly a narrative that is a predominantly about white character who comes in, who's mysterious or has a very mysterious background, helps the protagonist, and then dies or disappears. That's the magical Negro trope, and he has a lot of those. And a lot of them are in my favorite narratives. Like, probably my favorite book is The Talisman by Stephen King, and Speedy Parker is very problematic. And that was written by Stephen King and Peter Straub, who's also one of my favorite authors as well. But yeah, that's that. That's one of my criticisms. Yeah.
Did you ever think about including a magical white person in any of your books?
You know, the magical tropes aren't very interesting. That's the thing. It's like, that's the problem. It's like, we don't know the character. We don't know anything. We don't know the character is basically there for a purpose, and I'm not big on tropes, you know. I'm big on characters who are developed and who I hear, you know, who I hear and feel.
One thing that's always fascinated me about books that include a character or characters who have some special power or ability is that there's always a requirement to keep that thing a secret or a risk involved in everyone knowing what that is. And and I wonder if you think there's something about human nature that causes us to think this way about the things that might be the most powerful within us.
That's a really interesting question. It's a good question. I think that a lot of times the things that we see as those things that are most powerful in us, those things that are magical, those abilities, a lot of times we view them with a negative lens. So there's that. And because we view them in this negative way, we tend to keep quiet about it. We don't really want to bring that forth as the thing that makes us who we are. And that's something that I often think about when I'm writing with these characters, where they tend to embrace those things, either from the beginning or eventually they tend to embrace them. And when they do embrace them, that's when their lives really, really open up. But I think that those things that are special within us, too often we see them as negatives. And that's a problem.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. I know that you're a parent. I wonder if you were the kind of mom who could tell a story out of thin air at bedtime.
Yeah. Actually, I have a children's book called Chicken in the Kitchen. It's about a giant chicken.
That's a great title.
In the kitchen. Yeah, exactly. Isn't it? It's just like just saying it is so much fun. And that the story is based off of the story that I made up out of thin air that I used to tell my daughter over and over and over again. And not just tell it. You had to tell it, you know, like really tell it with all the emotion and all the facial expressions and the descriptions of the giant chicken in the kitchen. And chickens are my daughter's favorite animal. And she loves eating chicken, too, which is weird. Which is weird. But that was one. And then there was another one. What was it called? The Elgort and Garbage Soup. It was... It was, and I still remember this story. It was like about this beast in the jungle. It was in the same world as one of my books, Zara the Windseeker. And it was just destroying this jungle. And, you know, the two main characters had to create something to make it go away. And they went to the market and got a big can of garbage soup, which is disgusting. And the animal came and ate it and was disgusted and then ran away. You know? It's just ridiculous. But yeah, I would definitely do that. And my daughter expected it, and she expected all the voices and everything. And I enjoyed that because I think, yeah, I guess I'm a natural storyteller.
Do you remember when that occurred to you that not everyone could do that?
It's not something that I thought about. Like, it's like the talents that I have, I don't think, can other people do these things. It's so mine that it's not something that I think of other people doing or having. It just doesn't occur to me.
This is part of your existence.
Yeah.
I'm curious, because your imagination is so vivid, I feel like a lot of people have imagination, but we spend our adulthood like shoving that into a corner because we have taxes to file and, you know, floors to sweep. I wonder if the things you dream ever find their way into your stories?
Things that I dream. Sometimes they do, but my dreams are so linked to what it is that I'm thinking about and what I'm writing that it's almost not a coincidence, you know? But if something random does pop up where I'm like, whoa, that's a really cool creature, you know, I will put that right in a book. Like, I will have no problem putting it in there and it working. I take from whatever gives me, you know, like wherever I am or whatever I encounter, if I feel like it would be great in the story, I put it in the story, you know? So if something pops up in a dream, oh yeah, I wouldn't even think twice about that. That would go right into the story.
Are you always aware of those things as they happen? Like, do you write them down somewhere?
But that's come with years of writing, where just being aware and being my writer's eye has gotten wider and wider and wider, you know, the more that I do this. So I'm always watching, I'm always listening. And when I find something, I write it down immediately, because you can lose it. And when you lose it, sometimes, well, if it's really amazing, if it's really moving, you'll remember it. Like, there's something that I came up with even just this morning where I thought about it while I was sleeping, and I was thinking, oh, I should get up and write that down. And then I went back to sleep, and I still remembered it when I woke up.
Nnedi Okorafor's books include, they include Who Fears Death and Binti and Akata Warrior. She's also done Shuri Comics and Black Panther Long Live the King for Marvel. It has been such a pleasure to talk with you. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.